Well, it's been a couple of weeks since we've been studying in Judges. I think of two F's, view and faith. Steve mentioned faith just now. When you think of faith in the book of Judges, you see some situations arise where it looks as if the people of God are so outnumbered, so oppressed, that there's no way possible for them to do what God wants them to do. The faith in Him they have is so strong, it's willing to do what God wants them to do, regardless of what odds of this world go against them. And that shows, once they accomplish that, the power of God to help them through with their faith. But with reference to the word few, you have this as a continuing theme in various passages. Do you know of other passages besides 300 here going against at least 135,000 or more? Do you know of other passages that talk about few and what we should learn from those outside the book of Judges? Anybody? Ms. Joy? Mm-hmm. One angel versus 185,000 Assyrians, and they didn't have a chance. They wake up. What is the King James? They woke up and they were dead. But you know who was dead. It's obvious what happened there. Any others? That's a very good one. Any others? What do you think of with reference to the word few, even in the New Testament? Matthew 7. Here are... If you want to go by numbers, you better not, because there are few that are saved. In Matthew 7, along with Luke 13, are there few who are going to be saved? Jesus starts talking about these people who are always knocking on the door, and then when they expect it to open, it doesn't open. And they say, well, we were walking in the street with you. We sat and listened to you out in the street. We heard you preach. We had a good taste of religion, so why won't you let us in? And he points out, instead of focusing on the number, you better focus on what you do with my word. And if there's just a few of you who are willing to do that, you'll be the ones who are saved. And if the majority choose not to, then they'll be lost by their own desire or lack of desire, in the way you want to put it. Any others? Matt? So? 1 Peter 3:21. Few, that is, in that instance, it's eight, are saved by water. The whole world perishes, but eight people? That is incredible. Matt?
You may have mentioned this a couple weeks ago, but 1 Samuel 14:6,
by many or by few. And that's a theme you see running like a thread through this historical section, starting in Joshua and going all the way through to the poetic section. It will be highlighted even in the poetic section. And you can see one person who's going to stand with God is a majority. And that's not just a cliche. It's just what you see over and over again. Ms. Joy.
And then in the destruction of Jerusalem, mm-hmm. The remnant.
Yeah, you have there a few as opposed to the many in Jerusalem who are going to be destroyed. A few are willing to listen and to heed what Jesus says, and the most are not. Yes. Okay, Tim?
Many are called, few are chosen.
Many are called, few are chosen. You see that Matthew 20 kind of highlights the parable he tells there about the fellows who worked and thought they deserved more. Excellent answers. Any others? Okay. When you look at the battle that's taken place in chapter 7, it's been 2 weeks since we talked about it. Give me just a second here. It's not a typical battle. Why? What makes this a strange battle? One thing is, you have the children of Israel going to the battleground, and what is significantly absent? What's not there?
Weapons.
They don't have a spear, no bows and arrows, no knives, no guns, nothing. Then when you look at what is present, what soldiers were ever armed like these men? What did they carry?
A light?
And what are they going to do with a light? Shine it in their eyes and blind them while they choke them? They're going to use the light, and it's going to look as if, you have to remember, they're surrounding this camp. And when they break the jars and the light shines and they make this shout. The sword of the Lord and of Gideon, the sword is what God is wielding. They don't have a sword among themselves. It's God's sword. And the people in the camp start killing one another. You don't have to have weapons if your enemy is going to do the job for you. So they're destroying themselves. You just stay out of the way and let them destroy themselves. And you can chase them as they're on the way to their eastern side of the Jordan homeland. So that's a very strange thing. What it reminds us of that is that God is very consistent in all this. If you remember back in Joshua 2, the God who was able to conquer Jericho, and by the way, how was that city brought down? Was it by military might? Was it by military weapons? They march around it and they shout and they do what God says and the walls come down and they go up and then I'm sure they have some kind of weapons as they get in. But none of it's been typical from the first till now. Now, coming forward with that in mind to the New Covenant, to the New Testament, what principle do we learn from what we've just been saying? Anything from Jericho to the Midian? Oh, yes.
Our weapons are not carnal.
2 Corinthians 10 makes that very point. If they were, we would fight, Jesus says in John 18. Our weapons are not carnal, but they pull down these strongholds. They affect men's minds. It's a battle for the heart. And the result is people can come to Christ with something that's purely helpful and harmless in itself. Not a true weapon as we would think of it. The sword of the Spirit is what saves. It cuts away what's wrong. It doesn't give one a weapon to use as the Catholic Church had done so many times in persecuting people and compelling people to do what they wanted them to do. Any other comments on that? Ms. Joy.
Also, the foolishness of God is greater than the wisdom of men.
Very good. You see this especially starting in Joshua. What general would have had his men circle the city like they did six times and seven times on the last day and then shout? No military manual's ever been written that would incorporate those tactics or would approve of those tactics. It has to be something else. Very good. Any others? Tim? If God is for us, Romans 8:31, who can be against us? If He is for us, we need not fear. And the context of Romans 8 showing that even if we die, God is still for us. And God blesses us more there even than He does here. We cannot lose if we're with Him. Any others? All right, excellent answers. Now, if we could start answering like that when we go over the judges, we would have it made. So we'll see about that next time. Okay, let me give you what I've put together as a four-part sections of chapter 8. Okay? This is my doing. You may have a better way, and if so, I'll willingly and gladly yield to that. It's a little bit difficult for me to put this into just four, but I'll try. And the first three verses, I put down Ephraim's envy. Ephraim's envy. And the second part, verses 4 to 13 and 18 to 21, Midian's retreat and defeat. Midian's retreat and defeat. And so you see as they continue to run, the battle's been fought. There are 15,000 remaining. And as they're retreating, they get across the Jordan. They're pretty far away from where the original so-called battle took place. And they think they're safe, and their guard is down, and here comes Gideon, and he's 300 against 15,000, and slay them all over again, and capture the king. So Midian's retreat and defeat. That's verses 4 to 13 and 18 to 21. The third one, and you know we English all these words, instead of Sukkot, I'm just going to say Succoth, and Penuel, something like that. We butcher all of our words anyway. Pay for their sin of omission. This is verses 14 to 17 especially. These are Israelite towns on the east side of the Jordan who decided to play it safe. And they found out that playing it safe is the most unsafe thing you can do. So that's verses 14 to 17. Succoth and Penuel will pay for their sin of omission. It's what they failed to do, not because of what they did. And then the fourth one, Gideon's finish, verses 22 to 35. Gideon's finish, 22 to 35. And I think that at least summarizes what we'll be seeing here. In verse 1, now the men of Ephraim said to him, "Why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites?" And they reprimanded him sharply. and I'm apologizing for this, I should have said in the last part of chapter 7, he had called, say for example, verse 24, the men of Ephraim to go to the watering places and capture these men, these few stragglers, as they're trying to get back on the other side to safety. And they do a magnificent job. And now they approach Gideon in great anger. They're very disturbed because he hasn't called them to the original battle. You didn't include us when you went up. Now, what's wrong with this, biblically speaking? What's wrong with their charge? They blame Gideon because he didn't include them in the original battle of the 300. What's wrong with this? It wasn't up to him. Who was it up to? God arranged this battle. God, they had it up to 30-something thousand. He said, send these home, you down to 300. Whose idea is that? God. Whose idea is it not to call Ephraim? God's idea. So they're barking up the wrong tree in this. God limited the army to 3,000. Their complaint is against God if they have a complaint. And the Ephraimites are pretty good at complaining. Now, Gideon does something here in Judges 8 that you won't see later in Judges 12. When they approach Jephthah with these same words, Jephthah says, well, I don't have to take that off anybody. And he starts slaying them, and several thousand Ephraimites are killed. Here, Gideon controls his tongue, and he might have asked the question. This would have just escalated, though. Imagine, your enemy is running away. You need to catch them. You need to stop them. They'll just raise another force and come back, possibly. And here are these men in your own nation wanting to talk to you about how you have discredited them and insulted them for not bringing them along to this original battle. You wouldn't let us be soldiers. And if he stays and talks to the Ephraimites, these enemies get away. So he's in a hurry. So instead of staying and fighting with the Ephraimites, maybe causing a civil war with them, he loses the war with Midian and they come back stronger than ever. But he could have asked them this question. He could have said, men of Ephraim, if you're so interested in fighting in a battle against the Midianites, now finish it for me. If you are so eager to fight these Midianites, what? Why have you waited this long? They've been here all these years, and what have you done? Nothing. You've done nothing. And now that I go out and we risk our lives by faith in God to do what He's told us to do, you come and say, well, you didn't treat us properly. You have here a contrast between Ephraim's outburst and Gideon's self-control. And what he basically does is say, what you have done, men of Ephraim, is so much better than what I've done, there's no comparison. Now you see this especially in verse 2. He said to them, what have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Ebenezer? Okay, there's several words that are taking place here that we need to talk about. But this is very incredible response on the part of a man who hadn't read 1 Corinthians 13. He hadn't read Philippians 2. But if you notice in 1 Corinthians 13 verse 4, when Paul is speaking on the subject of love, it suffers long. It puts up with a lot of stuff from people. And it's kind. We could stop right there and we say he's passed that test. You look at Philippians 2 verse 3. Philippians 2, 3. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself, others more important than we are. Look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. He's willing to tell them, you've done better than I've done, because that's what the nation needs, it's what you need, it's what we need, it's what God wants. Rather than when a bragging contest or win some kind of fight with these men verbally or otherwise, men who are just delaying what he wants to do. So if he represents this idea of love in 1 Corinthians 13 and Philippians 2, the Ephraimites are more like the works of the flesh in Galatians 5, 19 to 21. But he, nevertheless, deals with them in a proper way. He gets through with them and then he pursues the enemy like he needed to do. So that's a lesson in itself. It's always the case that people who have anger issues, like the folks of Ephraim seem to have had, people always are walking on pins and needles around them, walking on eggshells, we say, in order not to set them off. Well, he, for the better good, doesn't want to forget who the real enemy here is. The real enemy is not Ephraim, in spite of what they've just been saying. The real enemy is Midian, and there's still work to be done. So in verse 2, he says, "What have I done now in comparison with you?" Then he gives this illustration. "Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim," so that's what the Ephraimites have done, "is not your gleaning better than the vintage of Abiezer?" Who's Abiezer? Where'd that character get brought in? Who is he? That's the family that Gideon is a part of. So he and his father and others in his immediate clan are part, they're Abiezerites, part of this tribe. Now, his vintage can't compare with their gleaning. You remember, Leviticus 19 gave instructions to the children of Israel when they were engaged in reaping what they had sown. Leviticus 19, verse 9. "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your land." Anybody has driven a haymow? Or operated a hay rake? Lady? Hay rake. And we had the kind you had to push it like this, and it'd come up and put them in rows and push it again and time it just right. The old-fashioned kind. But as you go around the corner, leave the corner. Don't get what's in the corner there, because someone else is going to be coming, someone who's in need to take that. So what he's saying is, leave the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. What's the gleanings? Well, when you're picking up things, say you're getting grapes or you're getting green beans, and as you go through, you find that you've dropped one under a leaf, or you find that here's one that's growing under a leaf you didn't see. You don't go back and get that. Here comes the poor. He does see it, and he gets it. And so that's what he's saying. Now, in verse 10, "You shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor, the stranger. I'm the Lord your God." All right. What's he saying here then with the vintage and the gleaning? You remember Ruth 2, as Boaz's men are going about the harvest, bundling up grain and so on. Here she comes, and the part that falls is hers. So that's gleaning as they harvest. So what he's saying is, the vintage of Abiezer, the vintage that I have, when I had my men, 300 of us up there on the mount, and we shouted and broke those vessels and scare the daylights out of the Midianites, and they start running in one another with their swords and their spears and killing one another. That was the harvest. But what you did was pick up the part after the harvest when they ran down to the river. You gleaned some very important materials. And he mentions in chapter 7, verse 25, they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeb they killed at the wine press of Zeb, and they pursued them to the other side on the other side of the Jordan, Gideon. So what you see is they did more important things in who they captured and killed than he did when he brought in his whole harvest. That's all he's saying here. So he's using an illustration. So my full harvest can't compare to your mop-up operations, where you came along and really did a good thing. Ephraim had cut Midian off at the pass. So Ephraim would have benefited as much as anybody by the defeat of, Ephraim would have benefited as much as anybody from the defeat of Midian. It was right there among the people of Ephraim. You'd think they would be glad. You'd think they would be joyful. Instead, they find an occasion to fight in the strangest times. So, pursuing the defeated, he says, is very important. You've done your work well, and you should feel good about that. And I wish I could have done as much as you have. That's what he says. Well, in verse 3, he goes on to say, "God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. And when what was I able to do in comparison with you?" And as soon as he says that, their anger toward him subsided. They've killed the two princes. He apparently hadn't captured anybody. He had caused an initial destruction. But a civil war at this point with Ephraim, like is going to happen later with Jephthah and the Ephraimites, a civil war is not going to help the children of Israel. It's just going to make more destruction and bloodshed. The enemy will get away. The enemy can regroup. the enemy can come back. There are millions of these Ishmaelites and Midianites out there. So we're not doing ourselves a favor by fighting one another. So he says what we need to do is get along and oppose the true enemy. That's John 17, where Jesus prays that his disciples will all be one. Why? That what? Yeah, that's the way people will come to faith. They'll know the truth about what Jesus has done. So, there are some fights that are unavoidable. The one with Midian, God told him to do it. There are some fights that are avoidable. The one, for example, with Ephraim. We have to pick our battles. Just as in Nehemiah 6, Nehemiah is invited down to have a get-together to determine what we need to do about the problem internationally. And he says, I'm too busy. I have too much work to do that. He's not going to go there. Well, that's what you see Gideon saying to these people here. And no matter how hard you try, no matter how much you succeed in, no matter what good you may accomplish, there will always be someone like an Ephraimite who will try to poke holes in your record. Just as in Matthew 26 and Mark 14 and John 12, when Mary offers the Lord her alabaster box, a very precious ointment, what happens? Does everybody stand and say, I've never seen such an act of love and charity in my life? Is that how the disciples reacted? No, quite the opposite. They're indignant. You could have used that to feed the poor instead of wasting it like this on Jesus. So you see, that's going to happen. But you can't let that stop you from doing what you need to do. Comments on any of this? There are many lessons like that all the way through this. In verse 4, when Gideon came to the Jordan, he and the 300 men who were with him crossed over exhausted but still in pursuit. Long distance running is oftentimes a part of battles, especially battles in the olden times. Long distance running, you end up being tired, cold, hot, scared to death, without sleep, and very hungry. That pretty well summarizes it from what I've been told. I've never experienced it. But these men are in war, and this is what they're going through. So in verse 5, they come to Succoth. Now, you notice they've crossed the Jordan. It's on the east side of the Jordan, but they're Israelites in this area. He said to the men of Succoth, these are Israelites, please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I'm pursuing Zeb and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. So Succoth and Peniel both are Transjordan cities belonging to the Lord. Succoth means basically a place of tents or booths. It's where people lived in tents, apparently. And it was in much of the Jordan Valley on the east side. And these cities dreaded the wrath of the Midianites if they commit themselves to help Gideon. If we help Gideon, if we give him food and supplies and make his men able to continue their pursuit of these bad guys are all around us, and they number, could we say, in the millions? They're all over the place, and they're nomads, and they travel this way and that, and they could come at any moment and just wipe us out. We're nothing here. We can't afford to infuriate such a powerful enemy. So they think we need to take a safe course and not do what ordinarily we might do if the Midianites weren't here. Remember in Matthew 10:42, Jesus says that if a person gives someone even, what was it? Even something small. Even a cup of water. I heard the voice, but I couldn't see the face. A cup of water in my name only. He won't lose his reward. There are times when someone needs some water and a little bit of food and he can go on with his journey. He said, you'll be blessed. These men didn't know that yet. And they'll have to learn the hard way. So in verse 6, the leaders of Succoth said, and listen to the smart aleck response here. This is full of insolence. Are the hands of Zeb and Zalmunna now in your hand that we should give bread to your army? You know what that means? No. That means no. Yeah, it's a smart aleck way of saying no, but it does mean no. If you had the proof here that you've already defeated them, we would help you. But you don't have that proof, and we doubt you're going to show that proof. 300 men here, 15,000 at least, have pursued and preceded them. So they're not only turned down cold, they're even taunted. Everyone wants a sure thing. They think they have it. Actually, their sure thing is sure destruction. So in verse 7, Gideon said, for this cause, he says, if that's the way you want it, for this cause, when the Lord has delivered Zebah and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Now, I don't know if you've ever been stuck with a briar. Repeatedly I'll be gathering stuff up and I'll get stuck. And it's not very pleasant. You'd think I'd learn to wear gloves or something. But these people will have their flesh torn. I've never had that. I've never had some thorns and thistles and things grab the flesh and just rip the skin. But it's been known to do that on some. These are fence riders who will not commit to helping Gideon. They're politicians. They put their finger to the wind. They see which way it's blowing. And right now it's blowing in favor of the Midianites who remain, not these 300 who want to go conquer them. And if you're just betting on this from a military standpoint, leaving God out of the equation, they would be right, wouldn't they? Here's where the faith comes in. Their real problem is not, there's a whole bunch of Midianites and there are just a few of you Israelites, and this can't be done. Their real problem is what? They don't believe God. They don't believe God can do it in spite of all that He's done. So, they think they're playing it safe. Now listen carefully. What is the safe position? There's no safe position when it comes to making a choice. You can't say, well, I'm going to do what it seems to me is going to preserve my life. Jesus said in Matthew 12, verse 30, he who is not with me is against me. He who gathers not with me scatters abroad. So a person says, well, I want to take a safe position. What are the chances he was really raised from the dead? What are the chances he's really going to be standing there on the day of judgment and I'll give an account to him, as opposed to what all the smartest men in the world say is reality, not some pie in the sky? I better take my chances by living for the here and the now. But I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to take a position. I'll just be an agnostic. I'm not an atheist. I'll just be an agnostic and say, I don't know. Now, is that safe? Of course it's not safe. There is no safe position. You're either with him or you're against him. There's no third option for you. So we're forced to make a choice. I want you to notice also in verse 7. He says, when the Lord has delivered. It's not if. It's when. Now that's the language of faith. He has 300 against 15,000. But he knows the outcome before he goes. And furthermore, it's a when then. When the Lord has delivered these men into my hand, then I will. Then I will what? Tear your flesh. The word tear here is literally the word thresh. As in threshing floor, where they would have the grain lying out there with this hard shell on it called the chaff. They'd have the sledge, it's pulled over it. And as it was pulled over it, usually pulled by an oxen or a horse or mule or something, it would break the chaff off. They would then get the horse off. Sometimes its hooves would actually break the chaff off. Get the horse off, take their winnowing fork, their pitchfork, toss it up into the air where it has plenty of air movement. The chaff would blow away. The heavy seed would fall down. They'd gather up the seed and put it into their barns. Then they'd take the chaff and burn it up. To thresh, if you're that seed and you see this huge horse walking all over you and pulling this sledge, it comes and just rips your outer shell off. If you're a seed, that's pretty scary. What if you're a person and he's going to do this to you? He uses the word thresh. I'm going to thresh you. Cassanius, one of the dictionary writers, put it this way. Concerning this word, he said, a cruel punishment inflicted by the Hebrews on their captives by crushing them with the threshing wains of iron on the floor like corn. By corn, he means grain, not our maize. And he quotes Amos 1:3, where this word occurs again. This is what's going to happen to some of the heathens. What he's telling us is that treason is not a safe thing. If you don't stand with God, you don't have a safe position. The only safe position is with Him. So whatever this describes is not very pleasant. And then in verse 8, then he went up from there to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. And he gets the same answer. The men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered. These are more politicians. They want to do the safe thing, not the right thing. It's never safe to stand with God's enemies. It's never safe to distrust God. The main problem in both cities, they don't have faith in God. So you'll notice in verse 9, so he also spoke to the men of Penuel, saying, when I come back in peace. Notice, when, not if. I will, not if I make it back, I might, but I will tear down this tower. Now, why the tower? Well, I don't know for sure. One thing we do know for certain is they will be judged because of their sins of omission. Notice, both in Succoth and Penuel, the problem is not that they're doing something wrong. The problem is their failure to do what is right. If you'll notice in the judgment parables, especially Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the typical reason, in fact, almost every time it's this way, that someone is being destroyed or is seen to be judged as lost is not because of some horrible deed he did, but what? A great deed he failed to do. It's neglect. It's omission. It's failure to act. I was sick and in prison and you didn't visit me. It's what you didn't do. Lord, when did we see you this way? We surely would have done it. Or here's a man with the one talent. What does he do? He bears it. It's what he doesn't do that condemns him. It's the five virgins who take no oil. They have no oil. It's an omission. It's not an act that was calculated to insult him in some way. They just omitted doing what they knew was their duty. And on you go. And that's what you see here. These people have failed to take their stand for what is right. When he says, I will, that's not a statement of self-confidence where he says, my 300 are the greatest fighting machine in the world. We can take anybody on. We are the superpower. That's not what he's saying. This is a statement of faith. 300, he knows, is nothing. He wanted many more to go against the original group. This is not a situation where he's saying, there's no brag, just fact. Boy, we're great. No, we're nothing, but our God is great. And if there were just one of us, it would still be the same thing. This is total trust in God. Remember, there was an occasion where Gideon said, Lord, if you're for us, why is all this happening to us? I have a hard time believing in you. And then he gets to the point where he cuts them down to 300. He sees them killing one another. And he thought, that's the easiest work I ever did. Why didn't I trust God from the beginning? And now he'll never doubt him again. That's a lesson that comes through in this passage, and it's designed to help us today to have that same kind of faith. Now, comments on this before we go on. Matt?
Well, verse 10 shows most of the work was already done.
Most of the work's already done. Yeah, as it was in the previous battle. Zeba and Zalmunna were at Karkor, and their armies with them, about 15,000, all who were left of the army of the people of the east. Now, somebody writing this would have said, there's no way this could end like this. For 120,000 who drew the sword had fallen. So the 15 here and the 120,000, 135,000. Gideon still vastly outnumbered. And many would have died in the panic of chapter 7, verse 22. But this is the remnant of them. Then verse 11, then Gideon went up by the road of those who dwell in tents on the east of Nobah and Jogbehah. That's a great name. And he attacked the army while the camp felt secure. They felt secure. They're off guard. They thought, we have escaped the wrath of whatever that was. It killed so many back there. We've gotten away. Oh, this is a great day. We're here. They've crossed the river. They're out of bounds. You know how many times scriptures show people who think they're safe and secure when they're not? Paul would say in Acts 26, I verily thought within myself ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And I did. I shut these saints and men and women into prison, persecuted them everywhere I went. He thought he was right, but he wasn't right. He felt secure. He thought he was the best Jew in the world. And Philippians 3 shows his bragging credentials. He had everything. What was he? A lost sinner that he later calls himself the chief of sinners. Here are these people who say, Lord, we've prophesied in your name. We've cast out demons in your name. We've done many wonderful works in your name. You can't say we're lost. And he says, depart from me. I never knew you. They were so secure, even at the judgment. And that's what you see here. So they feel secure, but it's an insecure security. There's nothing to it. Now, 15 miles from Jogbehah to Jogbehah, to Penuel there. This is a long, hard journey for a man who's already exhausted. You've run all this way. You're dog tired. You're thirsty. You're starving. You're weak. And now you've got 15 miles to go from Penuel to Jogbehah. 15 more miles. That's not exactly the best news you've heard all day, is it? And it could have been better had they just given you some food. So imagine how that would feel. In verse 12, when Zeb and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them. And he took the two kings of Midian, Zeb and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. You can imagine Zeb and Zalmunna look up and they think, here are these 300 come again. They never give up, do they? And so they run, they catch them. In some way, I don't know, it doesn't explain it here, but in some way, Gideon and his men routed this entire army. Who would have expected 300 to chase 15,000? Here are men of faith. God is the one, of course, who did it. So they destroy the whole camp. Then verse 13, then Gideon, the son of Joash. Oh, wait just a minute. Let me ring a bell. Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from battle from the ascent of Heres. Now you would hope, just as an aside, they found some food in the Midianite camp. Isn't it ironic? They might have been fed by the Midianites, whereas their own people weren't going to give them a bite. But however that may be, in verse 14, they caught a young man of the men of Succoth and interrogated him. And he wrote down for him the leaders of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. Now that's quite a feat. If someone were to ask me to list 77 politicians in any city in the world, I wouldn't be able to do it. I wouldn't come close to listing seven. But the Hebrews are known for their memory in doing things like this. These are 77 men who have their names written in the book of death, not the book of life, because of an omission that betrayed them as being unbelievers in the God of heaven. So, in verse 25, he came to the men of Succoth and said, here are Zeb and Zalmunna. He said, a while ago, they'd said, are they in your hand already? He said, see my hand? See who's with me? See who I captured? Here they are. About whom you ridiculed me, saying, are the hands of Zeb and Zalmunna now in your hand, that we should give bread to you, your weary men? You know, they say that payday comes someday. And these people of Zalmunna now realize, these people of Penuel and Succoth both now see that payday has come for them. Now, they chose to believe that God would not conquer Midian and cast their lot by doing nothing with the people of Midian rather than with the people of God. In verse 16, he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. Now, what does that mean? I really don't know. I really wouldn't care to see it. But I don't think it's good. I think we can say that. I don't think it's good. This is not, if you were one of these men of Succoth and you hear that's what's about to happen, you're not going to be thrilled. So, this is an occasion where, for an omission, this kind of punishment comes. Again, that's like the judgment parables of the New Testament. The failure to act, not merely being wicked, but being wicked because you do nothing, as the one talent man. Verse 17, then he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. He kept his word. They lived to regret their word. Now, a tower rubble stands as an object lesson. We'll see more about that, the Lord willing, next week in chapter 9. But when you see this tower that's in rubble here, it's torn down. This is the tower they were in earlier, and they could be smart alecks in it. It tells you three things. It says, don't ever trust men over God. I don't care how many men there are. A few with God are more powerful than all these men. Don't trust numbers over being right with God. And don't trust neutrality over courage to do what is right. Being neutral is a good way to get run over from both sides of the road. Now, these people of Succoth and Penuel didn't have to join the army. They didn't have to run with Gideon. But they did have the obligation to help in any way they could. In a local church, not everybody can be the soldier running after the enemy. But he can at least supply the one who may be doing it and encourage him in some way. Then in verse 18, he said to Zeb and Zalmunna, what kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor? I don't know when this occurred, if it's recent or some time ago. But they answered, as you are, so were they. Each one resembled the son of a king. That shows you something about what Gideon must have looked like. They don't deny the charge. But in verse 19, he said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had let them live, I would not kill you. So here's action, reaction. Here's the result of consequences. It could have been a few years had passed. They thought they'd gotten by with all of this. And the result of it is now they perish because of it. And then verse 20, he said to Jether, his firstborn, rise, kill them, but the youth would not draw his sword. He was afraid because he was a youth. And this sheds light, I think, on what happens in 1 Samuel 17 when David goes out to fight Goliath. Remember Goliath's reaction? Here's a boy that comes after me? What an insult. If a military genius, a military giant is killed by a boy, that's like having a stone dropped on your head by a woman in chapter 9. There's not much glory in that. How did he die? Well, this little boy killed him. A little boy? And so he says here, he wanted his son to do it. In 21, Zebulun's Almana said, rise yourself and kill us, for as a man is, so is his strength. Gideon arose and killed them. He took the crescent ornaments that were on their camels' necks. I think that must be like royal license plates. They have these things around them alone. These are the camels that the kings ride. And in 22, the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. And God alone being king of Israel, there is no way Gideon is going to take that on himself. All right, our time is gone. Sorry about that. Any comments? Okay. Thank you for your help tonight.